Why the intelligence business may not be business as usual anymore. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In New York, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl, who is on assignment. It is Thursday, January 5th. Good to have you with us. We start today with news that President-elect Trump is expected to nominate Dan Coats, a former GOP senator from Indiana, to be his director of national intelligence. But since his election, Trump has disparaged and doubted the intelligence community, often 140 characters at a time on Twitter. So the next administration could bring big changes to the intelligence sector. From Washington, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
The business of secrets isn't exactly transparent, but we do know that private firms have long been involved. For example, the U-2 spy plane from the Cold War came from Lockheed Martin. But private contracted intelligence really took off after 9/11, when U.S. needs ballooned, says Courtney Weinbaum of the RAND Corporation think tank.
One day you need a Chinese-speaking cyber expert, and the next day you need a Farsi-speaking nuclear engineer.
You could hire experts full-time.
Or you could have a relationship with a company and you can rent those skills.
But one risk is that more companies get access to secrets that can leak out. And Bill Hartung of the Center for International Policy worries that outsourcing could increase under the next president.
The implication of what little Trump and his advisors have said is that they would reduce government size in some regards. My suspicion is they'll balance that out by hiring contractors.
One more reason, in the high-tech world of spycraft, the technology expertise lies not in government offices, but in private companies, says CIA veteran Jack Devine, now a consultant with the Arkin Group.
Using software, social media for intelligence purposes, collecting open source data, and it just requires a tremendous amount of technological support.
By one estimate, the private sector side of intelligence gathering takes in $50 billion a year. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
It's tough out there for a department store. Sears is closing more than 100 stores, and Macy's gave us a little more info about the store closings it had announced earlier this year. The company also said it's cutting thousands of jobs amid another round of weak holiday sales. Macy's is trying to figure out its brick-and-mortar future in a world of online shopping. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has a look.
Macy's will close stores in places like Durham, North Carolina, Bangor, Maine, and downtown Minneapolis, Minnesota, where a street performer played this bright little ditty outside the doomed store earlier today. The music didn't cheer up Leslie Fry, who's mourning the fate of her beloved Macy's.
It's a big bummer, yeah. I do a lot of my shopping for myself, my kids.
So you can't blame her for the store closing, but maybe you could blame people like Chris Micco. He doesn't shop much at Macy's, in person or online.
Amazon's just so easy. We have Amazon Prime, and it's just, you know, quick and painless.
As more consumers pay for Amazon Prime memberships and enjoy free shipping on lots of stuff, it's harder for retailers like Macy's to compete. So says retail consultant Carol Speakerman.
The expectation for free shipping and for fast shipping and for very clear delivery time frames rises.
Macy says it will plow some of the money it's saving from layoffs and store closings into its digital game. Retail consultant Bert Flickinger is optimistic Macy's will hang on. He says Macy's and Kohl's, which has also closed stores, are better capitalized than many competitors. He thinks they might even be able to grab some market share as other weaker retailers close even more stores than they do.
Macy's and Kohl's benefits because that's where the vendors want to be.
But he notes there are ripple effects when any of these retailers do layoffs. It means some workers will have less disposable income for buying stuff. In Minneapolis, I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
If you're a new parent, listen up. One of the many questions people with babies face is when to introduce their kids to peanuts. For years, pediatricians said to hold off until age 3 for kids considered at high risk of developing a peanut allergy. Today, that guidance changed. The National Institutes of Health now recommends that parents introduce peanut-based foods at around 6 months of age, and even earlier for babies at high risk. The reversal is obviously big news for children's health. A peanut allergy is one of the most common and most dangerous food allergies, affecting about 2% of kids. But the change could have economic consequences as well. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Managing food allergies is expensive. One study put the cost at about $25 billion a year. James Baker is chief medical officer of the group Food Allergy Research and Education. He says beyond direct medical bills, parents have to buy different foods or enroll their kids in special schools and camps.
And importantly, parents often have to restrict their job activities or other things in order to achieve a safe environment for their family.
So a big reduction in peanut allergy would save lives and money. Baker helped develop the new guidelines after a study showed that early exposure reduced peanut allergy by 86%.
So if that holds up, this should result in marked decreases in the peanut allergic population going forward.
And that could eventually put peanuts back on the menu at schools and other places where the nuts are banned or restricted. Naturally, the peanut industry is thrilled. Bob Parker is president of the National Peanut Board.
Most children develop a love and affection for peanuts at an early age. And when doctors are telling their parents to avoid giving it to them, they learn to like something else instead.
Parker's grandson has a peanut allergy, so he empathizes with parents. But he's also hoping more kids will now develop a taste for his product. The new guidelines recommend feeding kids peanut-based foods not just early, but often throughout childhood. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, mixed. Details when we do the numbers. The city of Sheffield in the north of England was once the world capital of steelmaking, but its industry crumbled under foreign competition in the 1980s and then slid into decline as countries like China geared up their manufacturing. Now, Sheffield might get a big influx of investment from China, and not everyone in the city is happy about that. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
If Sheffield has a monument, it's this, 28 feet high and weighing 400 tons, the River Don engine. The world's most powerful working steam engine sits rumbling and hissing and gleaming with oil in a city museum. An object of awe, says engineer Eddie Foster.
Nobody comes and say, I've seen one bigger, or I've seen one more powerful or more spectacular. This is pretty much it.
The steam engine, which once powered a steel mill, is a memorial to Sheffield's glory days as the steel-making capital of the world. That industry declined sharply in the 1980s. Ever since, the city has scrabbled for alternative sources of revenue. But recently, a fairy godmother arrived on the scene.
A gentleman from China has been to the city, thinks it's a great place to invest money, and has talked about £1 billion of investment.
Richard Wright of the Sheffield Chamber of Commerce. He says a Chinese construction billionaire, Wong Chengming, is checking out the possibility of a big real estate project here.
It's great to get that sort of money and that investment in the city because it moves you forward faster than if you didn't get it.
Mr. Wong's interest in Sheffield is not fortuitous. His daughter studied at a city university. Education is now one of the biggest industries here and has attracted tens of thousands of students from China. And there's another link between Sheffield and the People's Republic, a less academic activity.
Slow drag shot or power screw back?
Sheffield is home to the World Championship of snooker, a game like pool.
A lot of people in China know Sheffield because the minute you say Sheffield, they say, ah, the snooker. There are more people watch the World Snooker Final in China than the rest of the world put together. It's an enormous marketing tool.
Not everyone applauds the growing links with China or hails Mr. Wong, who made his first fortune in bamboo, as a saviour. I've come to the town hall to speak to a sceptic, Councillor Jack Clarkson of the UK Independence Party.
You've seen the headlines. Former Chinese bamboo salesman riding to the rescue of the city of steel. That's not the way you see it then, Jack.
No, I don't, actually.
He's worried about the first phase of the development, which could see the council relocate the central library and allow Mr. Wong to convert the much-loved old building into a five-star hotel.
Sheffield City Council now are selling off our silverware, our heritage of Sheffield, to the Chinese. That's what leaves a real bitter bad taste in my mouth.
And Labour unionist Tim Jones is not impressed with Mr Wong's hotel either. He feels it'll bring only low-paid service jobs to the city, while China's been further eroding the industrial base elsewhere in Britain.
They're dumping cheap Chinese subsidised steel in this country. Wouldn't it be better, instead of dumping cheap Chinese steel, to start manufacturing steel
in this country?
In this country.
If Mr Wong goes ahead, he won't be the first Chinese businessman to redevelop this city. Jerry Cheung came here from Hong Kong at the age of 13 in the 1970s. Today, he's building a $100 million retail and residential development.
We want this to be like the Times Square of Sheffield, but with a Chinese flavour.
Cheung is slightly put out that Wong is being described as a Chinese pioneer, but he has no doubt that Sheffield will benefit from more Chinese input.
What do you think Chinese investors can bring to this city?
That energy, that can-do kind of attitude, that hard-working mentality.
The energy and attitude that built the city of steel? In Sheffield, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Back in 1865, novelist Jules Verne predicted the moon landing. Well, kinda. He wrote a science fiction story called From the Earth to the Moon. It's about a club of people in Baltimore who try to launch their members into space. But what I'm getting at here is that sometimes fiction can predict the future. That's sort of what Wired is up to with their first science fiction issue. It's pretty cool, so we brought in their head of editorial, Robert Capps, to talk about it. Welcome to Marketplace.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so obviously my first question, why do a fiction issue? You guys are a journalistic organization.
I guess the way we thought about it is that one of the things that Wired is supposed to do, or one of the Wired missions, is to look ahead to see what's coming next, to see what the future is. And we often do that by taking a hard look at the present. And we realize that so much innovation actually gets its start in fiction, in plays and movies, TV. And we thought it would be interesting to see if we got some writers and said, we want you to maybe look at some of these concepts that we're dealing with now, artificial intelligence or space travel, you know, write us a short story about some possibility. And our hope was that maybe we would get a glimpse into tomorrow by doing that.
Many of the visions in here are pretty dark.
Yeah, it went pretty dark.
Why do you think that happened?
Well, I mean, I think there's a couple of reasons. One, I think that we started doing this issue. Gosh, I mean, probably the idea for it came up a good 8 months ago, and we actually were approaching writers 6 months ago. But I think that going back 6 months, we had a very bitter election. We had a lot, you know, we had a mass shooting at a nightclub in Florida. Really, it's not so much dark or even pessimism, but uncertainty. There is some warnings of, you know, we should think about how we want to go forward and what we want our society and our planet to look like.
Yeah, I mean, there is this sort of call to action that Neal Stephenson wrote about or mentioned, which is that sci-fi writers should be more intentional and be more optimistic in imagining the future, because if you think in a dystopian way, that then sets a path out. Do you worry about that?
I think that is funny because we did the Obama issue right before the fiction issue, and he talked a lot about Star Trek in there, which is the most optimistic show about what the future can look like. And it's interesting to see when people imagine a future optimistically, how it can really capture people and galvanize them. And one of the shows that imagined the most things that we have today, from cell phones, the tablets, was Star Trek, because it imagined a future that we'd want to go to. And so when people are building the future, they're like, what would be cool? What would it look like? And they think back to this cool world that they saw. So I do think that Neal Stephenson's right. That said, for our issue, we wanted it to – it's really a moment in time. And so we let it be what our writers wanted it to be, that within there you can also find the sort of beacons of light and hope in addition to the things that you would want to avoid.
Business Insider made an interesting list of sort of things that have come true from fiction. You could think of Mary Shelley imagining transplants, Jules Verne predicting submarines. What in this issue do you want to see play out?
You know, I think that it's interesting to think about the issues of universal basic income. And I do think that there is some amount of rethinking what our human role in society is and not just shaped around making money. We place a premium on our identity for how much money we make. And if your job doesn't make money, it seems less valued. But that means we have school teachers that feel less valued and artists and musicians. And I do think at some point doing some of our human endeavors unconnected to or less connected to what the dollar sign is an interesting thought that would be really wonderful to see our society advance in a healthy way towards that.
Rob Capps, head of editorial at Wired, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up.
Even clients of the Banfield Pet Hospitals are surprised to find out that the owner is, in fact, the Mars Candy Company.
Following the big money behind Big Vet. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was down 42 points, 0.2%, to land at 19,899. The NASDAQ added 10 points, 0.2%, to end at 5487. And the S&P was flat, finishing 1 point under yesterday at 2269. We mentioned Macy's earlier. It's a tough time to be a brick-and-mortar retailer. Macy's news took a toll on its share price today, which marked down a hefty 13.8%. Rival Kohl's also reported weak results, leading to its share being slashed by 19%. Nordstrom took some collateral damage, losing 6.8%. JCPenney slumped 7.2%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note dropped to 2.34%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, everybody. Molly here.
It's Kai, but you already knew that.
You did. But we have something that we would like to tell you together.
We are doing a new podcast. It's called Make Me Smart, about the things we want to know more about but don't always have time to dig into on this daily program.
Yeah, and it's about you, too, the things that you want to know more about and the things that you're an expert on. We'd like to have you on the show, too.
And mostly it's me and Molly having fun. Check us out at marketplace.org/makemesmart. There's lots more info there.
And please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you podcast.
This is Marketplace. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. When you think of Savannah, Georgia, one of the images in your mind is likely its giant live oak trees draped in Spanish moss. But in October, Hurricane Matthew knocked down hundreds of trees. The storm cost Savannah and the surrounding county upwards of $35 million in damage and cleanup. Now, some residents are trying to put those downed trees to good use before they get to the wood chipper. Georgia Public Broadcasting's Emily Jones reports.
At a large open lot in Savannah, trucks full of branches and logs line up waiting to be counted. Once it's checked in, the debris gets unloaded onto a growing pile.
And then that material gets put through the grinder, and we process it into mulch, and we stockpile the mulch.
Down Knight works for Ashbrit, a company that does cleanup all over the country. He's managing the operation here. His company has gathered more than 1 million cubic yards of storm debris, including many large old trees, some dating back a century or more. That got Brandy Mai, a longtime resident of the Savannah area, thinking that at least some of the trees shouldn't become mulch.
A lot of these trees have as much history as the town itself. They've seen fires, they've seen war, they've seen so many things. I know it's crazy to personify a tree as such, but these trees are just as much a part of Savannah's history as anything else.
So she started a Facebook group after the storm and quickly found she wasn't alone. Posts poured in from others hoping to do something with their downed trees. The group helped residents find local sawmills and woodworkers like Charlie Ward.
What I've been doing is taking a can out of the top and quarter sawing that, and then a couple thicker slabs out of the middle.
He starts to saw through a piece of hickory. For Ward and his wife Sarah, the mill is a fledgling business, what she describes as their startup, Sylvana Farms. They're hoping to sell a lot of this wood as lumber for about $3 to $4 a foot. That's comparable to a home improvement store because they're getting most of the trees for free in exchange for hauling them away. They estimate they'll get about 10,000 feet of lumber from the Hurricane Matthew trees. So far, they've had a fair amount of interest. And not only because the wood costs about the same as commercial lumber, but also because of what buyers can make with it.
Well, it's something special. It's something you don't just buy at IKEA or Walmart. And you kind of have a memory of it.
Bart Haig, a carpenter who's helping mill the wood, brushes off the freshly cut piece and points out its unique features.
You can see right now why that's such nice furniture wood. That nice dark brown in the middle with the contrast with the white, just absolutely beautiful.
He'll use slabs like the one they just cut for furniture, tabletops and legs, benches, countertops. One of those benches can sell for $500, while custom tables run about $3,000. A large tree can produce about 10 tables. But it will be a while before they see that kind of money. All this wood has to dry for 6 months to a year before it's ready to use. In the meantime, local businesses have gotten some storm souvenirs ready for gifts. Haig is selling coasters and cheese boards for $30 a piece. He says they're pretty popular.
Oh gosh, yes, a lot more than I had ever expected. My wife suggested doing this, and then all of a sudden I find myself making hundreds of sets of these.
Coasters aren't his favorite project, but business is business. And Haig says making something out of the down trees is important.
You've got to do what you got to do. The trees are down now. I'm sad they're down, but we've got to utilize them or it's even sadder.
He says he's got a long list of people waiting to get some piece of the trees that fell in their yards. In Savannah, Georgia, I'm Emily Jones for Marketplace.
This next story is about taking a pet to the vet, except the reporter we're talking to doesn't have any pets himself. He was home for the holidays and his family dog had an appointment, and it turned out that the vet office was being sold. No longer a family practice, it would be owned by a big corporation. So Bloomberg's Jason Klenfield started looking into this, and he found a pretty amazing trend. Hi, Jason.
Hi.
You know, I have this model in my head where, say, my dog or cat gets sick and I take him to the vet. And in my mind, the vet is like, you know, a little neighborhood veterinary clinic. Boy, your story changed my mind.
20% of the hospitals nowadays are owned by big corporations, and those corporations own the biggest hospitals. So there are really no good numbers on it. But, you know, the chances are maybe one third of the time you're taking your pet to a hospital that's owned by a big business.
One of the things in here that blew my mind is that the biggest chain of hospitals that we're talking about is owned by Mars, the candy people. So clearly someone is looking at this and saying, boy, this is a good investment.
Well, you know, that is a mind blower. That's one of the things that drew me into wanting to report on this story. We all know them for the candies that we love, but they own a ton of pet food brands. They're one of the world's biggest makers of dog and cat food. So, you know, it fits into the portfolio of what they do. You know, even clients of the Banfield Pet Hospitals are surprised to find out that the owner is, in fact, the Mars Candy Company.
What has this sort of franchise model or corporate model of veterinary care meant for care itself, for people's pets?
You know, my story is based on interviews with veterinarians and nurses at the two largest pet care chains. And, you know, and what these people say is that, you know, there is a great tendency towards, you know, kind of maximalist, defensive medicine. What that means is more testing and higher bills. And what these corporate pet care chains, the largest of them at least, profess to offer, you know, is quality control, you know, more standardization, more control over outcomes because they are doing more tests. They are reducing risk, they say. You know, the price of pet care has actually risen faster than the price of human health care over the last 15 years. It is a surprise. You know, corporate pet care is probably more expensive than your traditional mom and pop vet.
One thing that struck me in your story was how much like the human healthcare system the veterinary system is becoming. You know, we operate in a fee-for-service medical model where people get paid more by doing more stuff. And it's very hard to persuade a patient or a pet owner not to do that final test. Do you have a sense from your reporting about where all of this is headed?
Many of the doctors I've spoken with, you know, are just worried that the choice of visiting, you know, your small private practitioner is going to go away. And they worry that, you know, in the next generation, perhaps two, the small private practice is going to go, you know, the way of the old pharmacy. You know, at the moment we have, there is a lot of choice. But I think the concern among veterinarians is, one, they won't have any other place to work in the future. Mm. You know, and two, that pet owners won't have any other place to go to have their animals taken care of.
Jason Klenfield from Bloomberg News, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot for having me.
This final note before we go. If you hold stock in Toyota, today you saw your shares take a little hit when the president-elect tweeted about the company, saying it should build a plant in the U.S. or face, quote, a big border tax. The stock dropped about 0.5% before settling again. Well, the financial app Trigger has decided to take advantage of Trump's propensity to tweet about companies. Usually people use Trigger for a preset investment instruction, say trading on a Fed move. But now, Trigger can alert you if the president-elect has mentioned a stock you own on Twitter. There really is an app for everything. That's all for us. Today, the Dow was down 42 points, 0.2%, to land at 19,899. NASDAQ added 10 points, 0.2%, and at 5487. And the S&P 500 was flat, finishing 1 point under yesterday at 2269. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Suzanne Levy, Andrea Seabrook, Danielle Irby, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor is John Gordon. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. See you tomorrow. This is APM.